That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, warming shelters open in Portland ahead of forecasted freezing weather. The suspected killer in Portland's Normandale Park protest shooting is identified. And Ahmaud Arbery's killers are found guilty on all counts in their federal hate crime trial. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 22, 2022. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Temperatures in the Portland area are forecasted to drop several degrees below freezing in the coming days. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Kefouri and Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declared states of emergency ahead of the cold weather. The declarations will remain in effect from Tuesday, February 22 through Thursday, February 24. According to the National Weather Service, temperatures could drop into the teens by Wednesday morning. Wind chills are expected to push temperatures even lower, with gusts between 20 and 30 miles per hour. Freezing overnight temperatures could last through Saturday morning. Officials with the Joint Office of Homeless Services said five warming shelters will open in Portland starting at 8 p.m. on Tuesday. The shelters will remain open until 10 a.m. Wednesday, or as long as cold weather thresholds are met. Officials said no one will be turned away from the shelters and pets are allowed at the facilities. All the shelters are accessible to those with disabilities. People can dial 211 to request transportation to a warming shelter or ask for other information. TriMet will not turn away anyone traveling to and from warming shelters who cannot afford to pay fare between 6 p.m. Tuesday through noon on Wednesday. People are asked to let the TriMet operator know that they are traveling to or from a shelter. The man suspected of shooting and killing a racial justice demonstrator on Sunday night in Northeast Portland has been identified as 43-year-old Benjamin Jeffrey Smith. The Portland Police Bureau confirmed Tuesday morning that Smith remains hospitalized in serious condition. A spokesperson for Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt said the investigation is moving forward, and Smith could be charged regardless of his condition. Smith's roommate and neighbors have said he had grown increasingly angry with protests in the neighborhood and across the city, as well as the houseless community who live in the area. Demonstrators said the shooting happened after Smith allegedly started yelling at a group of protesters holding a Justice for Amir Locke demonstration at Normandale Park. Locke, a 22-year-old black man, was killed by Minneapolis police earlier this month. Witnesses to the shooting during the demonstration said people attempted to de-escalate the situation when Smith allegedly pulled out a handgun and fired into the crowd, killing 60-year-old Brandy June Knightley and injuring four others. Witnesses said one protester returned fire, hitting Smith, who is now in critical condition. A spokesperson for the Portland FBI's field office said the FBI is working with Portland police to investigate the incident. In a press release Sunday afternoon, PPB described the incident as very complicated and said, quote, "Investigators are trying to put this puzzle together without having all the pieces," end quote. On Tuesday, police said they believe people may have removed evidence from the scene and are asking those people or any other witnesses to contact detectives. A woman was killed and three others, including two children, were injured in a shooting that took place in Southeast Portland on Sunday night. East Precinct officers responded to reports of a car crash on Southeast Foster Road just after 10:30 p.m. They found four people in the crashed vehicle who had been shot. A woman was pronounced dead at the scene. She has not yet been identified. A man and two children were rushed to the nearest hospital to treat bullet wounds. Both children are stable and the man is in critical condition but is expected to live. Southeast Foster Road will be closed from Southeast 122nd Avenue to Southeast 138th Avenue while homicide detectives complete an investigation of the scene. Information on any potential suspects has not yet been released by the police. Portland has recently seen an increase in gun violence, with 2021 having the highest number of fatal shootings in 30 years. Police say the shots fired so far in 2022 are already on track to meet last year's record. Last year, Washington state lawmakers passed measures that reformed how law enforcement performs its duties. According to an ACLU Washington study, the reforms appear to have worked, as the number of deaths attributed to police were down 60% last year. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A year after their passage, police accountability bills in Washington state are showing signs of success. An ACLU Washington analysis finds a 62% drop in police killings through November of 2021, compared with the previous 2 years. Representative Jesse Johnson, a Democrat from Federal Way, was the prime sponsor of two bills last year updating use of force by police in the wake of George Floyd's death. He says he's seen a change, especially among new police recruits.
You can just see the officers coming in with an entirely different kind of guardianship mindset versus this warrior cop mentality in our communities. And I think that's great. They're asking more questions before going to physical force. They are doing deeper investigations.
But Johnson notes there has been criticism from some officers who say the new standards are too restrictive. He's sponsoring a bill that allows for physical force in certain situations, such as transporting people to mental health treatment. That measure has received support from groups like the Washington Coalition for Police Accountability that supported reforms last year. Another measure, which allows force when a person flees questioning, has support from Johnson, but critics say it could roll back last year's progress. Johnson says it's needed to clarify language in the laws. He adds that there are still checks on force, which must be considered reasonable and with an emphasis on de-escalation.
Essentially, it says that law enforcement have to use available and appropriate less lethal options. They have to de-escalate. They have to have time, distance, and space between them and the suspect. They have to take all these considerations into account, the totality of the circumstances.
He says some of those factors include whether a person is pregnant, if English is their first language, or if they appear to be having a mental health crisis. Johnson notes that there was no universal standard for use of force in the state before last year's bills, so each community had a different standard. He says for some, like Seattle, the new standards didn't change things much, but in rural Washington, that wasn't the case.
When you have totally different standards across the state and you put it all into one standard that everyone has to abide by, you're going to have people that challenge it because this is different from past practice. In others, it's not very different at all.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The three white men who killed Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, in Georgia in February of 2020, have been found guilty on all counts in their federal hate crime trial. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
The three white men convicted of murder in Ahmaud Arbery's fatal shooting were found guilty of federal hate crimes today. A jury found father and son Greg and Travis McMichael and neighbor William Roddy Bryan guilty of attempted kidnapping and ruled they had violated Arbery's civil rights and targeted him because he was black. The jury also found the McMichaels guilty of the use of a firearm in the commission of a violent crime. The verdict came down one day before the second anniversary of Arbery's death. All three defendants were previously convicted of murder in a Georgia state court and sentenced to life in prison. The hate crime element was felt to be important in demonstrating that racism motivated the killing. Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, said, quote, "Ahmaud will continue to rest in peace, but he will now begin to rest in power," end quote. The McMichaels had both agreed to enter guilty pleas to the hate crimes in exchange for being able to serve their sentences in federal rather than state prison. The judge rejected that deal after Arbery's family vehemently opposed it. To support the hate crime charges, prosecutors showed the jury about 24 text messages and social media posts in which Travis McMichael and Brian used racist slurs and made derogatory comments about black people. The FBI was not able to access Greg McMichael's encrypted phone. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the verdict, quote, "makes clear the Justice Department will continue to use every resource at its disposal to confront unlawful acts of hate and to hold accountable those who perpetrate them. Ahmaud Arbery should be alive today," end quote. Defense attorneys had contended McMichaels and Brian did not chase and kill Arbery because of his race, but because they thought he had committed crimes in their neighborhood. The jury consisted of 8 white people, 3 black people, and 1 Hispanic person. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Amid national conversations about banning some books in schools and libraries, residents of Northeast Arkansas are voicing censorship fears related to LGBTQ children's books. Books that some Jonesboro Public Library board members have previously attempted to remove from the children's section include The Gay BCs by M.L. Webb and It's Perfectly Normal by Robbie Harris. Emily Scott has more on the story.
Efforts to move children's and young adult books with LGBTQ content to the adult section of a Northeast Arkansas public library have some local residents concerned about censorship. At the Jonesboro Public Library, the latest book in a months-long battle over children's books that mention sexuality and other themes is All Boys Aren't Blue, a young adult memoir by George M. Johnson that follows his journey growing up gay and black. Jonesboro parent Valerie Carroll with Citizens Defending the Craighead County Library thinks having these stories accessible as young people explore their own identities is crucial.
When it comes to the library in Arkansas, LGBTQ youth in this area know that the community and the culture is in a lot of ways actively hostile to them. And so I think it's hugely important that there is some place where a teenager can go to see themselves. And if that place is the library, that's a beautiful thing.
The Jonesboro Library Board voted 3-2 against a proposal to move the book to the adult section. All Boys Aren't Blue has been removed from libraries in several states, where its critics have argued the subject matter is too explicit and that parents should be the ones to decide if it's appropriate reading for their kids. Vanessa Adams, who became the new Jonesboro Library Director last week, says she doesn't think the issue will end with the vote to defeat the proposal. She predicts it will likely come up again at next month's board meeting.
Moving the books is actually a form of censorship, and the reason that we hesitate to do that is because that's just the beginning. It's a slippery slope, and we don't know where it would end up, and so that's what concerns librarians.
Adams says the library hopes to reach a compromise, with plans already in the works to create a focus group to discuss options. She hopes the issue can be resolved in the coming months when the library returns to in-person programming as COVID cases wane. I'm Emily Scott with Arkansas News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference, and at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 23 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 40 degrees. Today in history, in 1819, Spanish Minister Do Luis de Onís and U.S. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams signed the Florida Purchase Treaty, in which Spain agrees to cede the remainder of its old province of Florida to the United States. Florida was organized as a U.S. territory in 1822 and was admitted into the Union as a slave state in 1845. The quote of the day is from American educator, humanitarian, and civil rights activist Mary McLeod Bethune, who said, quote, "We have a powerful potential in our youth, and we must have the courage to change old ideas and practices so that we may direct their power toward good ends." Vladimir Putin makes a bold move in Ukraine, redistricting legal troubles continue in Ohio and North Carolina, and an anti-Trump group wants to compete with CPAC. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times. U.S. and European allies move swiftly to impose sanctions on Russia after they say President Vladimir Putin breached international law.
I deem it necessary to make a decision that should have been made long time ago, to immediately recognize the independence and sovereignty of Donetsk People's Republic and Lugansk People's Republic.
President Joe Biden signed an executive order blocking new U.S. investment, trade, and financing from flowing into the two regions in Ukraine, which is currently surrounded by up to 190,000 Russian troops. The Ohio Redistricting Commission has until noon tomorrow to show why it should not be held in contempt for ignoring a state Supreme Court deadline. It was the third chance the panel had to draw fair legislative maps. Maki Somerset with the Ohio Organizing Collaborative says the new maps were rigged to undermine the voices of marginalized people and communities of color.
This is just another example of our legislators putting their own party over people's interests. At the end of the day, if we're going to build a democracy that works for all of us, that means that we need to pick our leaders and not the other way around.
A three-judge panel in North Carolina has until Wednesday at noon to set new legislative district maps. Two lawsuits argue the proposed maps gave Republicans an unfair advantage in elections and took power away from Black voters. And in Washington state, a new bill would ensure future maps comply with the Washington Voting Rights Act by requiring prior approval. Aldell Ramirez is a community organizer in the region with One America.
Litigation is costly. It takes away resources from communities that should better use those resources to provide services and infrastructure for their residents instead of fighting prolonged court battles or things over systems that are clearly in violation of the Washington State Voting Rights Act.
A lawsuit is challenging the way redistricting happened in the Yakima Valley, arguing the map creates a facade of a Latino-majority district. A grassroots group of Republican critics of former President Donald Trump are gathering in D.C. this week to support state and federal lawmakers who refuse to support allegations that the 2020 presidential election was rigged. The event, hosted by Principals First for America, is intended to counteract the programming of the high-profile Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando, Florida. Steel producers are asking the Biden administration to keep a Trump-era tariff on foreign-made steel. U.S. Senator Mike Braun of Indiana says import quota agreements with allied countries can be managed while protecting domestic steel production. But when it comes to more hostile nations, he says the administration should move carefully.
Dealing with Japan in the EU is a much different venture because it's got a little bit of a handshake and trust to it. I don't know if there's any of that with the relationship with China.
The 25% levy on imported steel was intended to stabilize domestic production. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland talks about parallels between her own family's residential school experience and Japanese internment as she tours a former relocation camp. And the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in two cases centering on Native American sovereignty. With that story and more, it's Shirley Jihad with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Shirley Jihad, in for Antonia Gonzalez. U.S. Interior Secretary Deborah Haaland referenced her own family's forced displacement as she acknowledged the 80th anniversary this week of the executive order that started the so-called relocation camps during World War II. Holland toured what's known as Camp Amache in Colorado. She met with Japanese camp survivors and their families. And in a virtual discussion about that event, Holland, the country's first Native American cabinet secretary, relayed her personal connection to forced family separation.
As some of you may know, I'm intimately familiar with the forced removal of families from their homes. My maternal grandparents were stolen from their families when they were only 8 years old and were forced to live in boarding schools away from their parents, culture, and communities until they were 13. To heal from these types of historical wounds that we carry, it takes a deep reckoning with these truths and a recognition that they have generational impacts.
President Franklin Roosevelt, on February 19, 1942, signed the proclamation that led to the forced incarceration of some 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans. Many were U.S. citizens. About 7,000 of those were sent to the Granada Relocation Center in Colorado. It's now known as Camp Amache National Historic Site. A bill to make that location part of the national park system is making its way through Congress. The leader of the U.S. Small Business Administration is making her first visit to Indian Country. She's coming to the Navajo Nation to discuss how the American Rescue Plan and the Infrastructure Investment Act can benefit Native American communities. Those two laws include $33 billion in investments for Native American communities. SBA leader Isabella Casillas Guzman is meeting with Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez and other tribal officials in Window Rock, Arizona, the tribe's capital. Tonga is back online after a massive blackout that lasted about a month and a half. Internet connections are restored and back up and running on the island nation. The massive volcano 5 weeks ago shredded the undersea cable that connects Tonga to the rest of the world. Now that that's repaired, residents report receiving emails and internet calls coming in from family overseas. That volcano January 15th covered Tonga in ash. It prompted tsunamis that flooded lands across the Pacific. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in two separate cases involving tribal sovereignty. The first case centers on gambling rights and Native American tribes in Texas. The question is whether a Texas state law banning gaming holds or whether the more permissive Indian Gaming Regulatory Act governs the tribes' rights to implement gambling on their land. It's been going through the court systems for decades. The other case the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing today involves double jeopardy. The question is whether rules against double jeopardy apply when a case is first tried in the Court of Indian Offenses, CFR courts. The specific case coming forward involves a Navajo man on trial for domestic violence and assault. He pleaded guilty in the Court of Indian Offenses. There he was sentenced to time served and released. Months later, though, after a broader investigation, he was indicted by a federal grand jury for the same offense and tried in federal court in Colorado. There he was found guilty, and there he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. I'm Shirley Jihad.
In conflict resolution, CBMs, or confidence-building measures, are used to prevent escalation, build mutual trust, and reduce military tension. As Russian President Vladimir Putin orders troops into eastern Ukraine, CBMs will be a crucial part of diplomacy and de-escalating the situation. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Last week, a tiny back page item in the New York Times reported that the president of Ukraine had come to believe that as much as he wants Ukraine to join NATO, it may be just a dream, suggesting a willingness to forego membership. Then came another small news item that might offer help, a report that Vladimir Putin has suggested using CBMs, confidence-building measures, to resolve issues with NATO, rather than strive for a comprehensive agreement that seems out of reach. CBMs are worth exploring. The idea behind them is that parties to a conflict take small but significant steps, reciprocally, to move away from a potential battlefield. Reducing tensions, preventing escalation of hostilities, and building mutual confidence in each side's motives are the immediate objectives. there can be two-party or multiple-party CBMs. Agreement on CBMs does not resolve a conflict, but it lays the basis for positive momentum that might in the end result in a settlement. Of course, each step of the way holds out the possibility of failure, either intentionally or accidentally. But that is also the beauty of CBMs. Since each step is small, any defect can be rectified or, if not, replaced with something more workable. CBMs depend to some extent on trust. Each side trusts that the other side will take a corresponding step back. As President Reagan once said, when talking about arms control agreements with Russia, however, trust but verify. Thus, CBMs are always accompanied by verification components, such as on-the-spot international inspectors, surveillance technologies, and reporting procedures. CBMs have been effective in European troop deployments, the nuclear agreement with Iran, and the China-India border dispute, and they might work in the current crisis over Ukraine. What might CBMs in that crisis look like? One common CBM is monitoring of troop deployments to prevent surprise attacks or misperceptions of intentions. Another is a ceasefire in border areas. Third is a pullback or reduction of forces from the Ukraine border. A fourth step could be removal of threatening weapons, such as U.S. missiles from Poland and Russian missiles from their own territory. Alternatively, a CBM would simply halt additional weapon deployments. There are also all kinds of economic CBMs that could be arranged, such as removal of U.S. and European sanctions step by step with Russian commitments to keep natural gas flowing to Germany and beyond. Very importantly, CBMs should be considered with regard to cyber attacks. Finally, CBMs also have non-military applications, such as social and cultural exchanges. Michael McFaul, the former U.S. ambassador to Moscow, writes in the current Foreign Affairs that Biden, quote, in concert with allies and partners, should seize the diplomatic offensive and counter with a comprehensive grand bargain for enhancing European security. Call it Helsinki 2.0, he writes. That idea makes sense, but in the present circumstances seems premature, and because it is so ambitious, more likely to fail than CBMs. Granted, CBMs only bear tangentially on the main problem in the current crisis, security in Central Europe. They don't meet either Russia's demands for a NATO withdrawal or NATO's demands for Russian withdrawal. In short, they don't establish a new European security order, as Putin has been demanding and Ambassador McFaul is advocating. But what CBMs might accomplish is substantive, verifiable steps that reduce tensions and, at the outside, start a trust-building process. And right now, we surely need a few small steps. However, even small, temporary steps may not alleviate the Ukraine crisis. NATO seems to be opposed to any move that suggests a weakening of its commitment to Ukraine's defense. Nor is it clear which CBMs Putin favors. We have examples of CBMs being rejected even when they seem so logical in preventing violent conflict. The China-Taiwan tensions have not led to agreement on CBMs, for example, because China first demands that Taiwan affirm the principle of one China. The lesson here is that although CBMs are relatively easy to devise, agreeing on and implementing them are no small matters. Let's hope that President Zelensky in Ukraine relents on his dream and Putin in Moscow agrees to CBMs. Because if they don't, we'll have war. I'm Mel Gertov for the Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 22nd, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Caitlin Backus, Mel Gertov, and Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Jonah Chester, Shirley Jihad, Mary Sherman, Emily Scott, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the Cable Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances. My name is Jasmine.
And I'm Sam. This is a show that focuses broadly on the interaction between the Portland community and the city's police bureau.
We're a monthly show that airs on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 5:30 p.m. right here on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Now is a great time to support this and other programs focused on how we live and live with each other in Portland, in Oregon, and in the wider world. If you're not already a member of KBOO, now's a great time. You can support KBOO's winter membership drive by becoming a member today. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. If you have the app, click donate. Join us and support local media and media platforms today.
Do it.
We've been tracking the ongoing work towards crafting a body-worn camera policy that the community is comfortable with.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the issues that we've been focusing on over the past couple of years have been primarily focused around reform measures in the city of Portland, which, you know, our listeners and we ourselves may be and often are extremely skeptical of these measures as they are designed. But, you know, we can't deny that there are a lot of people who've been harmed by police in Portland who are investing a lot in these systems and the outcomes that they theoretically can provide. And so we're covering them. But it can be a hard thing to focus on, and we